Hey guys, welcome to the Offstage series with Cameron Leach underneath the Rudimental Podcast umbrella. Welcome to the third episode of this series. And Cam, to be honest with you, I think that was one of the best ones we've done so far.
Yeah, it was good, man. We started with Godzilla and ended with existential college crises.
Yes, and which I think on both fronts, everybody can relate to. So with that being said, we hope you enjoy this third rendition of the Offstage series. Make sure that you subscribe, rate, and review everything the Rudimental Podcast, wherever you can find it on all major streaming platforms, YouTube. You can follow me at Heartwell Drums, also my website, www.heartwelldrums.com. As well, you can follow Cam on his social, Sea Leech Music, and his website. So, with that being said, here's Offstage number 3. At a more efficient and kind of higher effort rate when I have more balls in the air, you know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. You know, I got to bounce this, and this. And I was watching this thing of, it was like this attorney who turned into a triathlon athlete, and she's like a world champion or something like that, but she's still an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And so it reminds me of like when I was in school and I was doing the 14, 16 hour days, but like I was like a machine getting all this stuff done, you know what I'm saying? And I feel like getting back into that practice routine would be almost foreign at this point because it's so busy and it's so, but like you know what it takes to get into it, but you've been out of it for so long that you're like, it's almost daunting.
Yeah. Yeah, and I fell off. I mean, I fell off the wagon too last time we talked. I was talking about like working out and stuff. I fell off the wagon for a week, you know. Yeah. Like I went really hard. I did really well. And then when and I had things kind of laid out in a really great schedule. And then when you tack the one extra thing on, which for me was the orchestra shows, I don't remember what I did. I think it was like 10 services in a week or something. And that's not a ton, but it was to the point where like some of my days were really strapped, and I was like learning notes frantically and stuff like that. And yeah, I just couldn't handle it. So I don't know. I felt like before, you're right. Like when I would have all these balls in the air, all the spinning plates, I would definitely do a lot better. I think the pandemic spoiled me in the sense that I was able to focus on like individual things and really make them good. And so if I had a couple things on my plate, it felt great. But now like my to-do list is crazy long again, and I'm feeling like the squeeze of the deadlines, and it's not doing what it used to do to me. It's like I need to like change back. I think now.
Yeah. I don't know. Go on an ayahuasca retreat or something like that.
Dude, actually, okay. Speaking of ayahuasca, I didn't do it, but there's a movie on Netflix out right now called Synchronic. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so I don't want to spoil it or anything. I mean, the premise is like there is this drug called Synchronic that acts, you know, it's basically acts on your pineal gland with DMT, and it transports you, you know, it gives you a high, but for certain people it will take them to a different physical space entirely, so you will disappear and go somewhere else. It's actually, and so I saw it when we were, Sarah and I were scrolling through Netflix the other night, and I didn't, you know, like some of these Netflix movies are just like terrible. You know, they're hard to watch. So we always give ourselves like 15, 20 minutes and say, if this sucks, like we'll just turn on The Office or something. But
it's a good fallback.
Yeah, exactly. Like we turn this on, and I looked at the reviews, and sometimes I try not to do that, but this one had like 70, 75% across the board. And I was like, that's pretty good, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty average.
So, dude, it was a pretty good movie. Synchronic.
Synchronic.
You kind of like don't know what's going on in the beginning. It's one of those that kind of, as the movie develops, it tells you enough at a time to keep you kind of interested. I thought the pacing was pretty decent, but okay, I gotta ask you, did you see the new Mortal Kombat?
Okay, so Tori's stepdad, my girlfriend's stepdad, was watching, and I walked in the room, and I was like, uh-huh, this looks dope, because I've heard the previous one isn't, but I did watch Godzilla versus Kong, so that's about as that. Like, that's about as wild as I've gotten recently.
Okay, so we went to the, I haven't been to a movie theater, I mean, even before COVID, I wasn't going to the theater. Once every 6 months or something, you know.
I think I saw the last Star Wars like three months after it came out or something like that. So
I feel like the only time we go are like for those big movies that you almost know they're gonna be good, you know, or if they're not good, they're so nostalgic that you want to see them in the theater.
Yeah, I mean, have you seen, I don't know if you've kept up, but like film lovers are in that thing, like they're at the theater probably. Mm-hmm. They'll go see the same movie four times. They'll see, you know, like multiple movies in a weekend.
Yeah.
I, for one, I've never been like that. I'd rather just wait for it to come out on a streaming service, which we're getting that directly now. So who knows what theater is going to look like after this. But yeah, anyway.
Well, no, you're right. But so when I was like considering, okay, you see the Mortal Kombat previews. They have the first 7 minutes of the movie online. Like you can just watch the first 7 minutes as a preview. And I was like, oh man, this looks so sick, you know? And I've seen the old 1995 version a long time ago. And I played the original Mortal Kombat on my Sega Genesis when I was growing up. And
machine.
I know, man. And so, I don't know. I had this like connection to it. And I was like, I want to go see this in theater. So I started looking at it. And I had never been to like a Dolby Cinema. And I didn't really know what that meant. I just figured it had to do with obviously like sound quality. And then right. IMAX, I had seen like something in 3D IMAX when I was like, 7, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we went to the Dolby Cinema, which I guess there's not that many of them in the US, and there's one kind of close by here. And so we went over there, and dude, I'm telling you, like they put these rumble things under your seat, and like, you know, like the 50 sound bars all around you. I could not believe it was so loud.
I'm imagining you just sitting there just being like,
the first time your seat vibrates. Yeah, because I had read about that, and then like we're watching all these previews, and the seats weren't vibrating, and I was like, "Man, like I wanted my seat to vibrate, you know?" And yeah. I'm like reclined, and Sarah, like the movie starts, and the very first like, vroom type sound, the seat like shook, and she looked at me, and I was like, "Fuck yes, you know?" Let's go. I was so stoked. But
an hour and a half of just being like, "Whoa,
dude!" It was so loud, though. I mean, that was the one thing. Like, theaters are always loud, but this was like next level. It was like a plane taking off for like 2 hours, but I don't know.
I don't know if my ears can handle that.
It was a lot.
Yeah.
You could have worn earplugs and been fine, but yeah, the movie was like, I mean, you should go see it. I think going to theaters, I didn't realize what I was missing, you know, sitting on our couch with, like, we don't even have like a sound bar. We just have like these straight up TV sound, which is so bad.
Then like home theater sound has like raised its bar so high that like I had a friend who spent like $800 alone on their home stereo sound, like, and I think that's honestly cheap if you go that route.
Yeah.
And like there's towers of, you know, tweeters and like, you know, standards you know, speakers and stuff like that within these towers, sound bar. I got sound coming in from behind me
because
it's, you know, it's posted up on like the ceiling or whatever. And I was like, why would you ever go to the theater now? I mean, you've already spent $800. That's like 80 trips to the theater.
Yeah.
So, it's insane. And TVs are insane now. And so my girlfriend's stepdad was watching Mortal Kombat, or I think he was watching Mortal Kombat, and the next day he was watching Godzilla versus Kong on his 80-inch OLED, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, this is sick. This is insane. You know what I'm saying? So, quick review on Godzilla versus Kong. Not sure how I feel about it. I think everybody predicted the ending. If you haven't seen it, you can probably predict what the ending is. So, that was not a total waste of my time, but, you know, who doesn't love a giant gorilla and a giant lizard fighting every once in a while?
You ever see the old Godzilla movies with the claymation stuff?
Have you seen the first King Kong?
No, I have not.
So in grad school, I took a film score class, study a film score class, and that is considered the first best film score.
Yeah,
it was 1933 or 39. I can't remember. And we watched that thing, and I was like, "Why am I enjoying this? Like, it's actually kind of enjoyable, even though the animation's terrible and it's you know, it's all cardboard cutouts that they've, you know, done like stop motion filming with." But I was like, "Wow, this is kind of enjoyable. No wonder the franchise has lived so long." I think the same thing with Godzilla. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And but yeah, you know, I couldn't believe how much I was enjoying a 1930s King Kong movie, but here I was. So.
Yeah. At this point, it's more entertainment, you know, but like back then it was scary. You know, people were like freaked out by that, or like, you know, just any special effects back then was scary, and it's kind of hilarious. Yeah. Oh, man.
You know, I do enjoy film, but like, I don't know if I'm like a film freak. You know what I'm saying? I feel like that. To me, I'm more of like a TV show guy because I like the story to be longer and more detailed, I think.
I like the new trend towards like 10-part series.
Right.
Yeah, I like and that then, a lot more.
Like, there's movies that have come out that could have been a 10-part series. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
It's one of them. I can't remember what it was. But they've done it correct. Like, there's a show with Bryan Cranston called The Judge, I think. It's a 10-part series.
Huh.
Defending Jacob on Apple TV is a 10-part series. And it's just one season. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the story and this is how it ended. But it's like, I feel like that's what caters towards more what I like. But
yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of interesting, too, because you would think our attention spans would be shorter nowadays. Right,
that's what I was saying. Yeah, and everybody would probably be like, no, movies need to be 45 minutes long. That's what my YouTube videos are, you know.
Right.
Like, so.
Well, and maybe YouTube, maybe that kind of short attention span stuff that we do on social media makes us long for, you know, more investment in something else. And honestly,
yeah,
it could be monetary. Like, you know, you don't want to go to the movie, you know, spending a lot of money to go to the movie a bunch of different times or whatever, and no one's going to sit in a theater for 10 hours. You want to be able to get up and pee in your own bathroom. But
right, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting, but yeah, I definitely like those a lot more. Trying to think of some other, well, like Peaky Blinders for me is like some of the best TV that's out there.
Oh my god, yes.
And we've probably talked about that before, but
yeah, maybe. But like, there's just some shows that I get hooked on, and there's not a lot of them, to be honest with you. But one of them recently is For All Mankind. It's on Apple TV. And it's with Joel Kinnaman and the girl from One Tree Hill. I forget her name, but it's really good. It's about because I'm into space stuff. I'm from Houston, NASA, all that kind of stuff. It's about if Russia, the Soviet Union, got to the moon first in the 60s, and then us coming in second.
Mm-hmm.
And we are then in a space race to then build a moon base on the moon. So, like, basically what should have happened, you know, not necessarily the Soviets being first or whatever, but basically the further advancement of, like, our presence on the moon, this is what that show's about if it happened this way.
Yeah.
It's super interesting. Like, there's some events that didn't happen. Like, Watergate never happened in this show, so like Nixon is president through the first beginning of it, and then there's like a bunch of some of the Apollo missions were successful. Like, there wasn't that Challenger mission that was that exploded in the 80s or whatever. Like, that never happened. So it's like a super alternate universe. It's very interesting. I usually like more factual based shows, but this is it's pretty good.
So. Yeah. I've been longing for like a fantasy movie that's really good, or show. You know, like the Synchronic movie kind of did it for me in terms of movies for right now. It wasn't great, but it was good enough. But we watched something the other day called Time Trap. And like, you know, kind of poorly done, kind of weirdly paced. But the idea of it was that there's like a cave that is essentially like the fountain of youth, and time moves differently in this cave. So as you go into deeper and deeper levels, like you'll go into one level and you'll turn around and look, and you just see light, dark, light, dark, light, dark. And those are the days going by just like rapidly. And as you go into deeper layers, so like if you go in and you stay for a couple of hours, you're hundreds of years in the future. Or if you come out, you're hundreds of years in the future.
That's like that scene in Interstellar.
Yes.
Where he's like, 1 hour on this planet is 7 years. Was it 7 years in?
I can't remember.
I can't remember either. Yeah, that tripped me out. That's the part of the movie where every time I'm just like, ugh, cringe. I know what happens, but every time I'm just like, I think about all you're missing.
You know? I know. So it's like that, but like that, the premise of that movie was, it sounds kind of dumb, like a cave where time moves differently, but it actually was done decently in terms of the premise, but the actual pacing was a little bit weird and the acting was kind of not so great. But for me, I was like, that's a great, like if you could spin that out and do that, and again, it needed like a series, because the very end of the movie, you're like, oh, come on, like you're going to end it there. You know, you could keep going for episodes and episodes now because you've set this up so well. But yeah, I don't know. I've been wanting to get like a new fantasy show, because for me, Peaky Blinders was kind of like that realistic fiction type thing, you know? So, or not, I wouldn't call it historical fiction, but it was so realistic.
They call it like a timepiece, right?
Yeah.
Or something like that. Yeah.
So like that does it for me there, you know, and,
well, how well a TV show is shot is big for me. Mm-hmm. How it looks. It draws me in, to be honest with you. The aesthetic of it, like The Crown. I would never have thought I would like The Crown.
I never watched it yet.
Yeah. I think it's so well. It reminds me of House of Cards, mm-hmm. where it's House of Cards was very clean looking, very pristine. The sets were very, I don't know, the way it was shot. I think David, is it Finch or Flinch that was the producer of that? He does great work. He does some other stuff, but The Crown, I did not expect to like, and for whatever reason, I watched all four seasons so far.
Dang.
And but it's not like that for every show, dude. I mean, that's kind of why I like For All Mankind as well, is because it's so well shot.
Mm-hmm.
And Peaky Blinders is like that for me. The Sopranos was like that for me. It's like a really 90s kind of vibe to it. Early 2000s. So Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
not much else like that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of some other stuff, but yeah, even like the Joker, the movie, the way that they kind of, you know, if you see the color schemes on the Joker and all that kind of stuff they used.
Yeah, I still haven't seen it, but
really?
I've seen the best like clip people ever see with Robert De Niro and stuff like that. So.
Man, that's a great movie. I loved it. It was darker than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah,
which is why I liked it. You know, like they took it to an extreme, which was great.
Yeah. Well, Tori and I watched Seaspiracy, that documentary on...
Mm-hmm. Sarah watched that.
Don't know how I feel about it, to be honest with you. I've seen a lot of mixed reviews on it. And it's like causing way more of a debate than I think they expected, or maybe they did. I don't know. But it was... The whole time I'm like, okay, yeah, I could see that. And the other half, I'm like, I mean, this could be a little propaganda-ish.
Well, I think a lot of them,
you know, because,
everybody, anybody that makes a documentary like that has an angle.
Yeah,
and, you know,
what I was seeing on Twitter was like, I'm like, all right, y'all are easily convinced. I think
a lot of things like that just pander to the very loud social media crowd.
Yeah.
And then everybody, you know, everybody takes up the cause and it's like, actually, you know, let's take a step back.
Yeah. The echo chamber of Twitter. Like, I know people are going to agree with me if I type this kind of thing. And they targeted that.
Holding up the vaccine cards, man. Like that's one that I can't get into. I know. It's like the I voted sticker.
With the mask on.
I know. And it's like, I hate when people talk about it and then I'm talking about them talking about it, which is almost just as bad. Mm. You know what I mean? But Yeah, I
we're gonna offend some people that listen, but to be honest with you, like,
hey, come. I mean, look, I got my first.
Do you go do that when you get your flu shot?
I get it. We're ending a global pandemic. I get it.
Yeah.
But I'm disenchanted by social media right now. Just like
you are.
So, you know, I'm
I haven't seen you post anything in a while.
A long time. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to get back to it. I just, for me, that's one of those things, like the first thing they get chopped out of my life is social media. One, because it makes me feel better. And then two is because I have to kind of, I have to make time for it during the day. And it's so easy for me to say, like, I don't have time for that shit today. And so just to kind of get rid of it. But I think once I start practicing more, like for instance, on my music side of things, I'm not going to just post to post. If I'm not playing something, I'm not going to post about, like, cut it. Like, I cut the grass this morning and nobody gives a single shit about that.
You next lawnmower.
I know, like, but, so we'll see. I'm sure that's going to come back. Even Drums and Drams social media, I'm having a really hard time doing besides the YouTube, you know, because.
Yeah.
You think about how many.
I'm going to struggle with that right now because I was telling Tori about this. I was like, I think the algorithm hates me right now because I haven't been as active on both my personal and TRPs, and I, you know, I've been posting stuff or whatever, and we're approaching 100 followers on the Instagram, which is good. I would, you know, obviously that number, we would love to see that grow, but it's even on my personal page where I have close to 1,000, I am not getting as near the amount of view counts that I would like on my videos. And I really think it's an algorithm thing because I'll post every on my main feed probably like every 3 months. On stories it's different.
Yeah. But
on my main feed the last time I posted before that video was February or January when the Grant designed the new logo.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, yeah, I deserve this. So
yeah, it's like for me, I've gone through, you know, my biggest social media phase was like obviously during grad school, just out of grad school for
right.
I don't know how much longer after grad school, maybe 6 to 8 months, and then I kind of started to fall off because I got so busy, and then I would come back every once in a while and like hit it really hard for a few months, but it would take me a few weeks, if not a month, for the algorithm to like get down with me again,
yeah,
and you can tell when it starts showing you to more people. You know, and the quality of, well, when you first come back, if you first come back and post something like super cool, you know, like on stage playing a crazy lick, a beautiful video or whatever, you will get a lot on that. But your second post, you're done. Like,
done. Yep.
That's it. And then you have to rebuild. It's so funny. But, you know, thinking about algorithms, I feel like whatever the old Instagram algorithm was and the old Facebook, like I was really good at those. And obviously they changed constantly, but one algorithm I had never messed with was YouTube because I wasn't posting regularly. So like my YouTube was more just an archive anyways. It wasn't an active feed, but now like Drums and Drams primarily sits on YouTube. And I didn't realize when you become a creator and you get monetized, you can actually make posts on YouTube. Like I didn't know that. So now like I can make posts on YouTube as if it's a social media channel. And then I'm like, well, why do I need Facebook and Instagram? But then dealing with the YouTube algorithm is a whole other beast, you know, in terms of you can tell when it's showing your videos to people and time of day.
I feel like I do better on YouTube right now.
Mm.
I don't know why. I have no idea why. And so maybe it's because people look for certain things on YouTube. But like, it's not like we go on Instagram, like I'm looking for Bread and Butter by Andy Smith. And then.
Right.
Whatever, they're looking for people. They're looking for hashtags, maybe. I never really search for hashtags, but
yeah.
YouTube, I feel like I've done equally as good and better on. It's very strange. I don't know why, but was it you that was telling me the Gary Vee thing of like he just, it's like volume of posting or consistency of posting, right?
Yeah.
That will help you out the most.
Yeah, the story has changed a little bit. I mean, over time, like every day, if you do it like every day, what I was finding was that, you know, you would get like, you would have awesomely consistent numbers, but like the numbers were never crazy high, you know. But if you would do like once a week or twice a week and they were all just like super punchy, great things, those would be amazing numbers always.
Yeah.
But then, like, so it's just this weird game trying to figure out how to use it, and I don't know where it sits today. I know myself that I will never, like, I don't know if I had more to show from my life or I was just more grovelly back then, but like I could post every day, you know, and I had the time and I felt like I had the content mostly. Now it's like, man, if I come back to my music pages, I'll probably just tell myself like twice a week or something.
Right.
You know, and then leave room for if I want to throw something out that is random, you know, maybe that's a third time a week or something like that. But yeah, I'll never get back to the everyday thing. Especially because in our industry, no matter how big my Instagram following would get, it just doesn't really matter. It just doesn't. So
people will find, our community finds people.
Yeah. I'd love to hit that 10K number. That was always kind of my goal, just to get to that.
You're close, right?
Yeah. I mean, God, if I wanted to, like, I know how it all works. Like, I could have done it. It would just take a couple of months to get there and it would be fine. I just haven't put the work in. But yeah, even if you get to that, it looks great and I would love to get there, but it doesn't matter so much now. And I see people really chasing that kind of stuff. People that are like 3-4 years late to like using Instagram for what we do. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, it's great to chase that, but you know, it's not going to make you any money. Not that it needs to, I guess. Depends on your goals, but I like YouTube because YouTube can make you money.
Yeah, I mean, and you've reached monetization on Drums and Drams, right? So, mm-hmm. like, you know, for me, if I could get monetized, first of all, I think I've mentioned this before, maybe not with you, but people really underestimate content creation, like what it requires.
Oh, yeah. Right?
What it calls for. They really underestimate the fact that these YouTubers who are making millions and millions and millions, they don't have a life, dude. Like, no. Their life is vlogging and making sure they get a shot and making sure they edit it and whatever. Like, one of my favorite YouTubers, he's not anything crazy big. He's more mm-hmm. of like a tech reviewer. His name's Ollier, and
okay.
He's a British guy. And his videos... I think the only reason why his videos are so good and the reason why he has the time to do 4 videos a week is because he works for himself. He's a graphic designer or a web yeah. designer, has a million dollar business in that, mm-hmm. and then does YouTube for fun and monetize that. He's always talking about effortless income, or not necessarily effortless income. I forget the term.
Like passive residual, something like that?
Yes, passive income, yeah. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, one day he decided that he wanted to make tech review videos, which is a extremely hard community to get into, right?
Oh, yeah.
You have your monsters in whatever country. Like, you know, we have Marques Brownlee and a couple other guys. Canada has Peter McKinnon and, you know, mm-hmm. he's not necessarily tech review, but... but like, you know, UK has Ollier and all these guys, and what an extremely hard industry to get into. He was just making videos for fun.
Yeah.
A few years ago, and he turned it into this thing, and, he has the time to do that.
Yeah.
Because of his situation. Like, people just highly underestimate, especially if you're working by yourself, and mm-hmm. like, this guy could easily afford an editor and a manager or whatever, but he still decides to do it himself because he likes doing it himself.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's one thing that I realized once I got more into the video editing and all this, and editing the audio by myself and making sure the audio sounds good. There's a lot of money involved, a lot of time, and I just think people highly underestimate it.
Yeah, and you're right that the only way that even for my little thing, the only way to do it for me is because I am self-employed, you know, as a musician or whatever. But, you know, with work from home now, a lot of people like are not really doing their jobs during the day. They're just like wiggling their mouse and staying active or whatever. So like it would be a little easier nowadays for those people, at least for the time being. But
right.
Yeah, to have a job and come home at 5 p.m. and then be able to start shooting and editing, you know, forget that, man. I wouldn't be doing that because that's horrible. But, you know, when I can sit down and I can crank out 4 hours of recording in a row and then have all the stuff banked and then sit down and edit it one by one, you know, that's nice. But yeah, the numbers are interesting on YouTube. Like if I wasn't doing live streams, I wouldn't be making, you know, I wouldn't make hardly anything. But like ad revenue, I can make anywhere between like $2 and $5 a day, you know, which is not a lot. You get to the end of a month though, and it's like, all right, between $70 and $110, like that's not bad. You know, it's great to have a little chunk of change.
That's one bill.
Yeah.
Or something, you know.
But then, and that'll always be there because you'll always be making ad rev, and that'll grow and grow and grow, and that's fine. But that's like kind of the small potatoes, you know, the super chats, the live streams, you know, this month from that, I'll pull about 500 after YouTube takes their cut. And that's great, man. Like 500 plus 100 from ad rev plus the Patreon money. It actually, interestingly enough, works, but only for certain communities. You kind of have to know your community. Because like, I feel like if you went to the music thing, how do you get super chats, or how do you do live streams with music regularly? Which is where a lot of the money comes from. Like for bourbon, it's different because you can just drink whiskey online, talk about tasting notes, hang out with people in the chat. With music, it's like you need to be playing, you know, and then how can you play and interact with people? And you know what I'm saying?
You know what I've seen is I've seen these reaction videos start to be a thing.
Right.
Don't know if I'm a fan of it, but they're pulling numbers.
Yeah.
Somehow. And I never expected that. I didn't expect this community or the drum community as a whole to embrace that at all. Mm-hmm. And I've also seen Twitch streams, you know, people putting in requests for songs and like,
you gotta be a badass to do that. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that's Josh Manuel from The Issues will do that. And it's not like they're requesting like, play Actual Proof. You know, like,
but like, I mean, even like percussion. So I've seen a couple do that where they take requests and it's like, man, that's just a different level. You know what I mean? That, like, and obviously you need to be good, but that's like totally separate from our classical skill set. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. And even world and hand percussion and stuff like that, I don't know if anybody does that in that realm, but, to like, for instance, like if I'm working on Darbuka, like I have been for a couple months now, I'm still nowhere near her where I could be proficient on that instrument. You know what I'm saying? And if there is a, like, there's a few percussionists, I think, in the music industry that could probably do that. And other than that, it's like, yeah, probably, I'm probably not going to be doing Twitch streams with requests, you know what I'm saying?
Like, right.
So it's, I understand the, like, if you're a popular drummer in a popular band, you would have the pull in the audience to be able to be like, hey, I'm doing a Twitch stream, I'll play some requests, I'll also play well-known songs by my band. Like Josh Manuel probably does a bunch of Issues songs, stuff like that. He probably also has the ability to be like, no, I'm not going to play that. You know?
Yeah.
Because he has way more options. People are you know, throwing in donations and whatever. Twitch donations, I wonder if that bubble will ever burst. Because they're still able to give, like, there's like 10-year-old kids giving donations to these Twitch streamers, you know, their parents' credit card or whatever. And these Twitch streamers have million-dollar deals with the service, with the streaming service, and then ads, and then also partnership deals and stuff like that, yet they're still getting donations. So it's like the rich get richer kind of thing, and there's like this whole push of don't donate to these guys, they're set for life kind of thing.
Oh, really? That's a thing.
That's what happening. I've seen. Wow. But these guys are still getting sometimes $1,000 donations, and you know, whether that's an accident or not, if they're a good guy, they'll reject it and be like, send it back or whatever. But,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Look, man, I mean, I'm all for people getting paid.
Yeah.
The more that I do things that are, like get up and play a show, like whether it's a concerto recital or whatever, it's like, you know, I don't look at someone who's making way more than me, who's like a violinist pulling 10K on a concerto, and say like, screw them, they shouldn't make that. It's like, no, man, make your money. You know, that's the way I feel.
I've heard that number sevenfold.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Depends on who it is.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And,
dude,
but dude, make your money.
I've heard that for a trombonist as well, who I was working on a project with, and yeah.
But I don't know. I'm happy for people, you know, and yeah. You should be making that money. And it is tough because to actually start on a platform like YouTube or Twitch, being unknown in an industry is really, and then trying to build on the platform. Like for instance, yeah, if you're a drummer in an already established band and you have a big following because of that, and then you just jump over, the initial wave of people is going to be huge.
Yeah.
And then you're fine because you already have something you're known for. But if you're trying to get known at the same time as like trying to monetize, that is crazy hard. And I mean, that's kind of what I did. Like I thought Drums and Drams would have a lot of people pulled over from the music side of things and I might have a little boost. I didn't have a boost. So yeah, I'm kind of in that thing where it's like, I feel like I'm just scraping by or just clawing my way through it, and it's working, which is great, but it's a much slower process than if, I don't know, like if I really went hard and tried to monetize my music on YouTube and flipped over there, it would be much easier to kind of just like within 2 months get monetized, figure something out there. So yeah. At the end of the day, it's like you have to have a skill set to start these things. You can't just, so many people, I like high school kids or whatever, are like, I just want to be a YouTuber. It's like, well, what do you do?
Yeah.
You know,
because there's a lot of talentless people already.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Like, what would you like to do?
What do you do? But I mean, even like guys like, for instance, Jake Paul or any of these other dudes that really were just like making crazy videos or being silly or dumb or
Vine.
Pranking or whatever. Like whatever these people were doing, that is kind of a skill set.
They're marketing geniuses.
Yeah, right.
Do people not understand this whole boxing thing is just a marketing?
I loved it. Did you watch the fight?
I did not watch I watched the highlights. Which yeah. The one highlight is him just Askren just getting,
dude,
obliterated.
It was just a weird fight.
He can actually fight.
Yeah,
Jake Paul can actually fight.
Yeah, and I love it. Again, it's like he is such a douchebag to just so many people, and it's great because he knows it's a character and he knows he's just making gobs of money and he can do whatever I'm all for that. We should
he's
want
gotta
people
be worth,
yeah,
he's gonna be worth 100 M's. I mean, it's gotta
oh
be.
Yeah,
yeah,
but we should want that for people, you know. It's like,
yeah,
because that dude, like you're saying, you know, when he started off, any of these people, they were doing all of the work on their own content. And it is endless freaking work. Like, I can't imagine, like, sitting here and cutting in the same scene. I can't imagine going out and holding a camera and vlogging and then trying to sift through that footage and figure out, like, what you want to turn that into. That is an impossibly long process.
Socially, that's stressful in itself. Like, I'm the guy with the camera in the middle of a freaking
oh, yeah, Walmart, it's weird.
Yeah, it's very strange. And, you know what? Admittedly, I tried to vlog a couple weekends ago.
Uh-huh.
In the making of our video and stuff like that, and I forgot throughout the day. I'm getting set up, you know, I'm setting all this gear up, setting my camera gear up. I was responsible for camera gear, and Chase, another member, was responsible for audio recording.
Mm-hmm.
Another guy was responsible for hardware. Another guy, you know, whatever, and like we're just all so worried about what's going on. I'm like, dude, how do people even like remember to like, for instance, I watch a golf YouTuber who is always in his videos. He's like, I'm going to try to vlog more. And like, he posts this vlog 2 days ago and it's him and he's vlogging himself, getting to the airport, flying to a tournament, getting to the hotel. And then he cuts. And at the end in the video, he's like, I forgot to vlog. And everybody's like, damn it. We just want to know, like, we want to know what it's like to be a tour golfer or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he keeps forgetting the vlog. And I could relate because I tried. I really did. I was just using my iPhone. And there was a certain point, I'm like, well, it's too late now. I've already missed a huge chunk of what you would need for the video. And I guess I'll just try again next for our next project, which we're working on. And I was actually kind of disappointed. I was like, oh man, it could have been a cool video, but I just totally forgot.
I sound stupid saying this, being the talent and also being the videographer is very hard. And
yeah,
I guess what I mean by that is not that just talking to the camera isn't being the talent or whatever, but it's much easier if the only thing that you're doing in your vlogs is talking, right? Like right. If you have to, like if I had to show up to a gig and vlog it and then get on stage and play a show, that that mind fuck of that stress would be impossible.
Yeah,
you know, like
switching.
I did, like I used to go on tour and I would take pictures of my setup. I would maybe make a little thing on stage, but I wasn't like crafting a vlog. I was just like single posts or stories or whatever. That's different. And even that was really, really hard. But like, yeah, the mindset shift of doing that, or like you're saying a golfer trying to, it's just impossible. So
he's trying to win a tournament, you know?
Yeah.
And we're not like we're trying to like win a tournament or anything, but we're definitely trying to make a good video.
Yeah.
And so we were, dude, and you can probably relate to this. We got in there and just like that, 6 hours flies by.
Uh-huh.
6 hours. And we, you know, we did all these takes and we, you know, we actually ended up having some pretty good full runs. We, you know, did our thing, our magical editing and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. There's so much that I thought I was prepared for and I wasn't, you know, as far as like my end of the stuff goes.
Yeah.
And which was a learning experience in itself, but I mean, I could not believe, like, it was like a vortex of time where we started, you know, did all the stuff and looked down at the clock 6 hours after we had got there. And I was like, holy crap, dude. Like, yeah. What happened? It was insane.
Yeah, classical sessions, well, you know, classical, quote, whatever, recording sessions are really hard. I absolutely despise doing them, you know?
You know what? I mean, we would do them in grad school and it was kind of a mix. It was marimba band pop arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're still in UNLV's on-campus studio, legit session kind of thing. And classical sessions require a little bit more detail in the recording side of things because of, you know, the sounds that you need, the kind of setting that you would need. We were messing around with mic placement and stereo angles and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. It's definitely something that we're going to be more prepared for the next project that we have lined up. But, and I have a lot that I could have done better that I just wasn't aware of as far as like video setup goes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, classical sessions are something else, dude. I mean, especially when it's an ensemble setting and everybody has a job to do. And, you know, I'm like, beforehand, I was like, look, if somebody messes up, just say it and then we'll start over. You know what I'm saying? Kind of thing. Because sometimes, like, people are scared to say they messed up. And I'm like, no, dude, please say you messed up so that way we don't waste 5-6 minutes. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? So,
yeah, it depends if you're playing with a click or not. But, you know, we did with Orphic, we did everything. So we did a session. Well, I guess that was last summer maybe, and I'm still sitting on the EP and I need to edit the damn thing. I need to cut it and then take it to somebody and have them help me mix it. But the worst thing you can do for me now that I've done this a little bit, and even with like video stuff, like the drums and drams, the worst thing you can do is have too much material, in my opinion, because then you have too much to sift through and too many choices.
Yeah.
It's like, when they talk about like shooting photo or shooting video, you want to get it right in camera as much as you can and not have to do a lot of posts on your photos or your videos. That's 100% true, because like then you're just sitting tweaking and wondering like, is this good enough, you know? But like with Orphic, we have so much material and it is so daunting for me to now have to sit down and go through all of these takes.
Dude, I can 100% relate. And we only did one piece.
Yeah.
And like, there, Yeah, I'm just gonna say I relate because there is just, like, there is so much that I had to sit there and be like, oh, okay, I get it now. So, yeah. I mean, I am not a video and, you know, audio video like expert by any mm-hmm. stretch of the term, but I am definitely like beginner level and I could definitely learn a lot. That's what I'll say after yeah. this last video project. And look, that may come through in the project. I'm still proud of it and of the final product, but mm-hmm. at least I know each project will be better after this one.
Yeah.
And I will definitely understand that setup is everything. Let's just yeah. put it that way. So
yeah, we actually programmed our clicks. Like, this is what was like, we had thought about some things, like, are we going to use click? Are we not going to? We didn't make a decision until the last minute. And so, like, we would say, okay, Monday, we're going to record these two pieces, or we're going to try to, you know, we might get only a piece and a half into that. So the night before, we would sit down and I would have my Logic file open and I'd be programming, because we'd be like, okay, we want to excel here just a little bit. So we'd be programming the clicks and singing the piece and trying to figure out how much we're going to excel and decel, because we wanted everything to be recorded to a click for the yeah. first, you know, for the first project, so that when we cut and edit it, it's super easy. And then maybe yeah. down the road when we have, like, when we're in a session, because, like, I was the engineer and I was playing the session, so that was not great, you know? And so, like, we would play and then I'd run over and put the cans on and, like, listen to the take, and then we'd fix mic positioning and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, maybe we don't do a click next time, but we needed it for this. And so we would sit down and program these clicks, and then we'd get in there and be like, man, it doesn't feel fast enough. So then in the session, I'd be reprogramming the click tracks. Like, oh my God, it was horrible.
I weighed the option of click so much in my head the day before.
Yeah.
And we ended up not using it. And I think we should have in certain parts at least. And overall, tempo-wise, we were pretty okay. Mm-hmm. And I don't, there's also that debate of, like, is using a click blasphemy? And it's like, no. And that's the kind of the problem with classical percussion, is that yeah. we think that we're some elite kind of machine, you know? And yeah. I think next time we will. I think,
yeah.
Yeah.
I like it. And it makes shooting the, like, if you're going to shoot video to it, like, because you can shoot audio and video at the same time, but you get yourself into a world of trouble when you start cutting up the audio and the video doesn't line up if you didn't use a click. And then you have to cut video at certain moments because of the audio so that it aligns. And then that might not be musically a great spot to cut in and out. So, you know, we shoot audio first, and I always shoot audio first now before I shoot a video. Most things that people are going to see from me from here on out probably are going to be music video style shoots. Even if it's a single angle of just me front facing, I've probably already recorded that to a click, and I'm probably not actually, I mean, I'm playing the instrument, but you're hearing something else because it's just cleaner that way, you know? And
yeah.
I did the work to record it. Like, there are some pieces, I don't know, it doesn't matter, but Premiere, you know, sorry, go ahead.
No, oh, sorry. I'm just saying Premiere has this really cool timestamp alignment mm-hmm. thing that I discovered. Do you use Premiere or do you use?
It's Premiere.
Yeah. That was a lifesaver because, like, they take the timestamp from, or time code, forget the
Sympathy
term.
Time code.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they sync it with what the camera audio received along with what the audio is. I don't know if I did it right. It just mm-hmm. lined up. You know what I'm saying? So it was
yeah.
a lifesaver. But as far as, like, the multi, like, making a multicam video,
mm-hmm.
it took me 2 hours to figure out how to do that. Like, because the terminology I was using
mm-hmm.
in Google was incorrect.
Right.
And I was like, I'm getting all this stupid, like, I don't want a multi, like, I don't want, like, a camera here, camera here. You know what I'm saying? I want to switch between.
Yeah.
And I finally figured it out. But that was a lifesaver, the synchronized kind of, you know, align with the time code or whatever. That saved my life because we ended up, using a certain audio track from a different audio recording for a different video, mm-hmm. I think. And to be honest, it's all a blur at this point because I was editing for 8 hours, like trying to figure out how to do all this. Now it'll take half the time, probably mm-hmm. less next time. But yeah, I'm glad you said that because that makes me feel better about the route I took, you know?
Yeah, no. I feel like shooting music video style always is cleaner. Like what we did was we shot all the audio. I rough cut the audio, which is not like, because there are some things, when we did it to a click, it was fine. There's a moment, like for instance, we have a piece where the beginning is completely out of time. There's no way to put it to a click. And so that's going to be slightly different every time. And I just went through and was like, I hope this is the best one.
Yeah.
You know, and I listened to all of them and I was like, I think this is going to work. I'll punch a few notes in later. So I took that and then I attached it onto the part of the piece that goes into a click track for the remainder of it. And then, you know, we set up two speakers and we just played along with what we were hearing in the speakers and shot the video to it. Okay. So it's like, it's all going to be there. But the beginning, I had to just like listen to myself playing this random Achel and then, you know, slow down. And then when we got into the piece, we would have the click blaring with our previously like rough recording of it.
Yeah.
You know, so that's how we are going to shoot all the videos, or how we shot all the videos. And it's just easier to produce that way. You know, I do that in my basement too. So
yeah,
I used to though, like my recording of Burritt Variations that's on YouTube is like, I think there's like 19 cuts in that, like audio cuts.
Yeah.
Which, you know, for a 10-minute piece is actually not that many. Because you can cut things up as much as you want, you know. Back then, like I didn't know what I was doing, and I was working with some buddies, and we were shooting video and audio at the same time. So anytime there's an audio cut, the video has to cut too.
Yeah,
putting that shit together is impossible.
Yeah, I got to figure out a workflow. I got to figure out a workflow that works, and I got to figure out a system like you that you described, like this, mm-hmm. either like the speaker thing or the, you know, whatever, something. I definitely think a click is in the works for the next one, just because mm-hmm. it's first of all, it's way harder than the last piece. The last piece, while it wasn't hard, we wanted to provide an example of the piece to be like the standard,
right,
that people would reference. You know what I'm saying? And then for this next one, not a lot of people have recorded it. Mm-hmm. And that's why we want to do it. And so we're trying. I got to figure out a system that works like you figured out. And mm-hmm. I think that only comes with trial and error. So, because, man, it is a bitch to record this stuff.
And dude, like, fly me down, I'll do it.
Hey, man. Pay you in crawfish or something like that.
Yeah, I have a lot of fun doing that stuff now. Like, with Orphic, it's a lot of fun. Like, what's great is when you know enough, and like, we did a live stream at the end of we did a bunch of recording sessions, and then we did, like, this live stream or something. I'm trying mm-hmm. to think of how we did it. Oh, no. Okay, so it was in November. We had a concert that we were pre-recording and sending to a university for them to air. And we, for some reason, man, went up to the last minute. Like, we should have given ourselves a couple-day buffer. And, like, we recorded everything. And then I stayed up all night, like 24 hours, and sat in the same chair, and I edited. Like, I sat in the same chair, I remember, for 16 hours straight. And I was just in the computer. So I cut all the audio with as few cuts as I could make, but as many as were necessary to like eliminate some wrong notes and stuff.
Right.
Cut all the audio, and then I had all the video stuff. So I cut the entire concert in 16 hours. Light, and I mixed everything too, like light mixed, you know, all the multi-tracks. And then just being able to do that. Like if I didn't have the skills I had, we just straight up would have missed our very large fee for that concert, mm-hmm. because it just wouldn't have happened. So to feel like I did that, and then the next day we had to set up and do a masterclass for them in a different venue, and I had like 80 minutes to set up. Multicam, multi-track, you know, running through my interface into the live stream software and everything, running through like OBS. And it's like, I was like done and early.
Yeah.
Setting up, you know, just, but being able to know all that stuff, it makes you feel so good when you get to a gig and you can troubleshoot like right away.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just not at that point yet. Well, I think I'll get there, especially if we keep going with these ideas we have. And right now we're doing more drum centric stuff because not all of us have access to keyboards.
Yeah.
And so, which is fine. At the end of the day, the whole reason why we're doing this is because we just want to play. You know, like if you can't find an opportunity to play in this setting, you might as well create one, you know? And so, like, you know, like I said, it's going to take a few reps, I think. And this one's going to require more rehearsal. This one's going to require more, it's going to require just a little bit more detail. But I think if, you know, I was really proud of what we did this first go around because it was not even two full rehearsals of preparation. It was, you know, it was good for what that was in that situation of like all of us live in different places where we're getting used to that aspect. And, you know, you have to rely on people's professionalism, which I think we executed pretty well. So, and if that's the case and everybody shares the same mindset, people are just you're going to get better as a group, which I'm sure you can relate to.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm definitely proud of the project, but I'm very much more excited for what the next ones are going to be because of all that troubleshooting and trial and error, like we're talking about. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's when you have to do everything for a project like that, it feels so good at the end.
Yeah. Dude.
You know, it really does. So rewarding. And that's kind of how the Orphic thing has been for us too. When we get together and, you know, sometimes we'll do one rehearsal and then go play a concert and go do a run of shows, or like we've had everything from that to then having like a couple of days of preparation. Like we've kind of run the gamut on it. Yeah. Premiering pieces after rehearsing them like 1.5 times. Like we were like, we get 40 minutes on this piece and then we got to go premiere it. And it just is what it is. And like, yeah, the professionalism in that situation, just kind of knowing that we can handle that almost like there's, you're riding on the edge, you're on that fine line. It's kind of fun that way.
Yeah.
But we get to the point now where we're like, guys, we can't keep doing this. Like it's unsustainable to feel like this before every show.
I'd rather feel way more comfortable in the performance than that. I mean, obviously you got to take what you can get. Right.
Right.
But man, that gave me chills just thinking about that. Like that's, I've had nightmares about that kind of situation.
Yeah, we had to we went up and played. We were premiering a bunch of new works on like a really legit concert series in downtown San Francisco in this beautiful church, and it was like, oh man, you know, like that gig ended up being like rehearsal. Like playing on stage was like a rehearsal because then we went to Germany right after and played, and it was like, that's when it kind of peaked out there. But oh man, just those gigs though, it's so fun to look back on them, and they really, I don't know, they kind of sharpen you a little bit.
I think so. I mean, your eyes are glued to the chart a little bit more than you would like, but
yeah, right.
You know, I hope I'm in the right place. You know, like,
oh man. Yeah, that's terrifying,
dude. So. I've had nightmares of like, I've had a reoccurring nightmare of, it's a blue stage, it's lit up blue, it's a very small stage, small auditorium, and everybody's angled down to the stage,
you know?
And somebody comes up to me, I don't really know who it is, somebody comes up to me like, dude, you know you're up in 20 minutes. I'm like, what do you mean, what's going on? And they're like, yeah, this is your marimba recital. What are you doing? Have you not learned your piece? And I'm like, no, I haven't. And I like, then it shifts over to me in a practice room trying to learn an entire marimba solo in 20 minutes. And then I always wake up right before I hit the first note. It's like a movie, dude.
Oh,
it's
man.
Horrifying. The feeling I get.
Yeah.
Like it's almost like I forgot that I had a performance. And it's kind of like the guy freshman year of college who forgets that we have an exam.
Mm-hmm.
And like he walks in, he's like, why is everybody so quiet?
Yeah.
You have an exam, dude.
Yeah.
Right.
Dude, I did that. So I don't remember what year this was. I think I was probably a junior, which is like when it becomes pretty inexcusable. But like there were two segments of this one, like pedagogy class that I was in, like, you know, like a music ed class that met at like 8 and 9. So there was 8 to 8:50, 9 to 9:50. I was in the 9 o'clock class. But apparently like an email had been sent out and I hadn't seen it, or I just hadn't paid attention. And it was like, everybody come in at the 8 o'clock class next Monday or whatever, you know, like, some special guest was going to be there and they didn't want to keep him for 2 hours, just one.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I get there at like, you know, 8:55 I was just like, what the hell? Like the door, like, where is everybody? So I just like open the door and walk in the class, you know? And there's still everyone's sitting there and they're like, hey, Cameron. And I was like looking and I see people from my class in there and I'm like, oh, what the hell? And like, honestly, I would have never known because I never saw the email or something. Like I just totally overlooked. So I was so confused and I was like, I said, look, I don't have an excuse for you. I fundamentally would have never gotten this right. So like, there was nothing I could have done. I will take a zero, whatever you want to do. Like, I'm not even upset at myself because I just didn't know, you know?
The embarrassment lies in the fact that it's 8:55 and you're waltzing in like it's like...
I'm early.
Man, this is great. I'm on time. I even had time to get a coffee. Like, yeah. This happened to me so many times in my undergrad. The sheer embarrassment of just walking in and everybody looking at you, just being like,
yeah.
And you're like, and dude,
I love it, man.
Oh my God. Those are the kind of things, like, I don't remember any good days. I remember the bad ones.
That's hilarious. Yeah. Yeah. I used to sleep on, cause I commuted from my parents' house when I was at Capitol, which was only like 20-25 minutes, but I'd be at school every night till 3 or 4 in the morning and then I would drive home. And so like it ended up being that if I was only going to get 3 hours of sleep, that almost hour of driving round trip would cut off like a third or quarter of my sleep depending on the night. And so I would just sleep on my buddy's floor at his place. Like I had my little roll of like padded foam from drum corps that I took and I would just roll it out on his floor and I'd sleep on his floor. And it was like final exams time. And we stayed up all night, like for our like marching band methods class, like creating, like, this is what they made us do. They made us handwrite charts, like drill charts. Like they wouldn't let you use software because our teacher was straight up 1970s. It was just awful.
I can heavily relate.
So we're like handwriting these drill charts to this like piece that he gave us, you know? Aztec Fire is what it was called. And anyway, so we're like doing it all night. We ordered Taco Bell and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna get like 2 hours of sleep. And I got like a conducting exam in the morning, you know, 8 a.m. conducting exam.
Dude, you're giving me PTSD.
And jeez. So like, you know, I wasn't super worried about the conducting exam, to be honest. It was gonna be fine. But then I like wake up and it's like 8:25. And like, you know, my conducting teacher was my band director and he was super, you know, he's a great guy. I mean, we work together now still, but I remember like, I was like, my hair is what it is. Like everything is what it is. I just fucking ran. I sprinted. Yeah. And it was probably like a, you know, 10 minute walk. I am sprinting. I run in. I kind of like sneak. I had like access to the closet, which had like a two-way, like two doors. So I like sneak into the closet and then I sneak into the room and he's like, hey, Cameron. And I was next up and he's like, you're not late to your exam. He was going alphabetical. I'm L, you know? He's like, you're not late to your exam. He's like, so get up there. It's no big deal. And I was like, oh my God. So like, I'm dripping like sweat, you know? And I get up there and I do my little conducting exam. Like I'll never forget moments like that, you know?
Dude, I almost like, after those you almost feel better about those situations because at that point it's just it is what it is.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And you're like, at least it's over. I mean, I didn't expect it to go that way, but you know, it's over.
Well, you didn't like stress leading into it. You just like you did it and then it was done and you're like, okay, I don't care. Dude,
I got the flu during my piano proficiency time frame.
Uh-huh.
And I'm hallucinating. Like I'm that sick. And we were hosting at our house. We were hosting a percussion ensemble that was coming in to give us master classes for after the semester.
Mm-hmm.
And they were called Bones, Jugs, and Harmony. And they
no, they weren't.
They were. And they played Bones, like the percussion instrument Bones. They played, you know, all this unconventional stuff. Tim Berg was in it. He's a Illinois guy. He's at the Academy, drum before, and Mark Eichenberger, and we're hosting them. But I have the flu in the back, and like I don't even know what day it is. Like my best friend, we were roommates together. We didn't go to the same high school, but we were best friends in high school, and then went to McNeese together. And he comes in, he's like, dude, are you all right? And I was like, I don't know. He goes, you just went in there and like with your shirt off and like made an appearance. And like, everybody's like, what's wrong with him? I was like, what are you talking about? You know, dude, I don't know what's going on. And then like, I was that sick. And so they had to like write an email for me for the piano professor to be like, yo, he's bad right now. Like, can he push it back? Whatever. This is the final piano exam.
Yeah. You
know what I'm saying? And otherwise, I would have to take it again, and I wouldn't be able to advance to certain things or whatever, however McNeese set it up.
Yeah.
And thankfully, she let me push it back a couple days because I couldn't even, like, walk, dude.
Yeah.
I had dreams that, like, I was, like, in a spider web. Like, I had in a forest. Like,
just think about, like, your college professors and how just lenient they were. You know what I mean?
Oh, like, my God.
Like, when I was teaching college, I had that in the back of my mind. Like, all of the people that were so good to me and I made it through and I feel like I'm a good player and I'm a motivated person. You know, all those things. And I'm like, so it's okay to be lenient, you know? But then you have to kind of judge everybody based on, like, whether you think they're putting in the amount of time that it takes to then earn your leniency in the situations that they screw up. You know what I mean? That is such a weird place to be.
You can be my mentor teacher when I was student teaching put it this way.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, I'll treat everyone fair but not the same. And
that's great.
Which is dicey in this time. But, you know, he would say that, and, you know, he actually ended up winning the Grammy Music Educator Award.
Mm-hmm.
And great educator, great music educator, and he was very right in saying that, you know what I'm saying? And so, like, when I was teaching history of rock for my GA,
mm-hmm.
I had my own class, and I was doing it online, and you know, I was Professor Hartwell, and I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. And I was getting all these ridiculous emails, you know, poorly worded, bad grammar. I don't really know what you're asking.
Yeah.
And I was pretty lenient for the most part because of those situations where what we're talking mm-hmm. about, like there's so many people that showed me grace and that like didn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And because they knew how hard it was to go through this degree or whatever. And so, you know, I was a little bit more lenient than I think I would have expected to be.
Yeah.
The West Coast really chilled me out in another aspect too. Everybody was just like, yeah, man, it's
yeah.
all good. And down here in the South, we're like, God, like, you know, we're going to yell at kids.
Yeah. You also don't, I mean, you just don't want to, for me, I don't want to perpetuate a culture of just complacency though. That's what sucks is like, because we already have such a glut of people in our industry that just, frankly don't deserve to be there. I hate to say that.
Yeah,
and a lot of them won't get jobs, and that's good because that's the market speaking and saying, hey, you're actually not good enough. But then it sucks because they were let through some, you know, crappy college program that just wanted to
they make need the
money, right?
Yeah, so, that's what so I was going to say. Yeah.
That's what's interesting is, like, you don't want to perpetuate that. And that was kind of my issue with higher ed when I was teaching is, like, and a lot of the situations that I was in, I was like, I feel like if I let you slide, even though I am giving you grace on certain situations, like, I'm doing this industry, it sounds mean, really mean, like, not doing the world a disservice, but I'm doing this industry a disservice by letting you be a part of it. Because, yeah, like, some of the kids, you can tell they are going to change. They are going to figure it out by year two or year three. But some of them, you know, you're like, you're going to waste your time. You're going to waste your money, maybe your parents' money and time. And it's like, someone needs to kind of shoot you straight here because
some realize in the halfway through the first semester.
Yeah.
I know there's people that we started out with 12 mm-hmm. percussion majors and two ended up graduating, three.
Yeah.
You know,
glad when that happens. I'm glad when I see people, it's like, I don't care that you're not doing, you know, what I'm doing here in the studio with you. Like, I just want you to find your, now at the time when I was a student, I would be like, another one bites the dust. You know, you kind of feel that way because it's competitive. But like, when you think more globally about it, it's like, I'm just happy for you that you might find what you're meant to do and be happy and make more money. And, you know, the emotional toll that it takes to be bad at something and continue doing that, and really you're not going to get better.
Yeah.
That's an emotional, you know, it's just distress for somebody.
For ended up being no reason. You know, it is a good thing when, like, somebody finally listens to what their brain is telling them, you know, mm-hmm. like, or their what their inner self is telling them, like, you know, maybe you shouldn't be doing this, or maybe you should be doing this, you know, kind of thing. Yeah. And I think it takes a lot. Maybe the theme of this podcast is trial and error, because I mean, there was times where I wanted to quit, but I knew I shouldn't mm-hmm. be quitting, kind of thing. And then there's other times where people feel the same thing, but they should, and not necessarily quit. It's more so allow yourself to find what you're supposed to be doing, kind of thing.
That's a good way to put it, man.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because it's sad when a talented person doesn't make it through, but there's another aspect where it's like, you know what, they were great at this thing, but also they're probably great at something else too, that's their mm-hmm. that's their place, that's their market, that's their passion truly. So it is sad when you see that, because, you know, there was a guy that I looked up to monumentally, and he was we were the same class, and he was so good going in, and he ended up not making it. He only lasted a semester and a half, mm-hmm. I think, or sorry, a year and a half. But now he's really successful in what he does now, which is great, because that's more of like a nobody's going to understand at first in that situation. Nobody else except for him. Mm-hmm. And now we all see why, you know. So it's, you know, that's the positive outlook. And then at first you're trying to be a good friend and be like, you know, maybe you shouldn't leave this. And then mm-hmm. years later, it takes all of us to understand that, okay, maybe he should have.
Yeah. Nice, man. This was a good one.
It was a good one. Right on the dot, too, of our time. So, hour 15.
I love hour 15. It always feels natural for me.
It does. Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, that was offstage number 3. Right?
Yeah.
Offstage number 3. Yeah, dude. We'll check back in mm-hmm. after a little bit, and, you know, keep this series going. I'm having a great time as always. And, as far as you guys go, the listeners, make sure that you continue to share, TRP, make sure you continue to subscribe, rate, and review, follow the description, read the description down below, and follow the support link if you're interested in supporting the podcast, just $1 a month, nothing crazy. But yeah. That's it for this one. We'll see y'all next time.